Hello and welcome to Men in Progress, the podcast of the United Methodist Men of Treach here in Flower Mound, Texas. We're part of the Life Plus God podcast series from Treach Memorial United Methodist Church. And you're listening to episode 28, a very special podcast from the men's group here at Treach. I'm your host, Dave Casey. And in this episode, titled A Heart for God, rather than the round-robin discussions we normally have, we're focusing on one intimate conversation with two of our members from Treach and two people I'm blessed to call friends, Jackson Blanton and his mom, Jamie. So Jackson and Jamie, welcome to Men in Progress.
Hello.
Hey. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you guys are here. This is exciting. So Jackson, for those that haven't met you, tell us a little bit about the journey you've been on for the last 5 or 6 years.
So growing up, I was just a normal kid, like everyone else, every other kid. Never even, you know, been to a hospital, never broken a bone, never had anything more than the flu. And then when I was in sixth grade, so 5 years ago, I was just walking down the hall and nearly passed out. Like, wow. My vision was closing in. I was lightheaded. I could hardly feel the floor beneath my feet.
Wow.
And, you know, we'll probably talk more about this later, but eventually I ended up getting a pacemaker, about 2 or 3 weeks later. And then, I lived with the pacemaker for 3 years. And then in September of 2022, I was fortunate enough to receive a heart transplant.
Wow.
And
how old were you then?
I was 16 then.
16. Wow.
Or I was just about to turn 16. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And since then, now I'm 17, and so it was about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
And I every day, you know, I push myself to get a little better and get a little stronger. And
sure,
so
yeah.
I'm very, very blessed to be where I'm at now.
No kidding. So there was like no precursor, you weren't tired or anything like that before? This just kind of hit you?
Yeah, I mean, it was just totally shocking. It came like really out of nowhere.
Wow.
But what's interesting is that later on they found out that what I was diagnosed with was called restrictive cardiomyopathy, and that is something that has to be, it's a gene mutation.
Interesting.
That causes that. And so I've had it since I was born.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
But it didn't...
but no symptoms, no
nothing. Yeah, nothing. It didn't manifest itself
until... Doesn't show up in a blood test or anything like that.
But if I'd have gotten an EKG any time before then...
Really?
It would have indicated that something was up.
Yeah. But who gives a kid an EKG?
Exactly.
That doesn't happen. Sure. Yeah.
So I think it's important to note that you can ask your pediatrician to do one. It generally costs about $20, but generally they don't do it unless they feel like they have some indication.
Yeah.
And so there are some, there has been legislation that they were attempting to pass in the past Texas legislature that would require it for student athletes, but it didn't pass. So I think our cautionary tale to anyone really that is interested is we would have seen it a long time before there were symptoms, but we just didn't think to ask for that. And so it's something that you can ask for, and it's not very expensive, and it takes about 5 minutes, and there's no like blood test or anything. It's just stickers on your chest. So it's really worth doing, particularly if you have a student athlete, because 9 times out of 10 children that are diagnosed with restrictive cardiomyopathy, it's diagnosed postmortem because they go to track practice or football practice or whatever, and unfortunately pass away, and then it's discovered. So
you hear about that. I mean, you hear about perfectly healthy athletes, particularly athletes. Yeah.
So I think like if there's one thing that we try to share with as many people as possible, it's that, you know, an ounce of prevention goes a long way.
No kidding. Well, wow. So, Jamie, let me ask you, this is obviously, as a parent, has to be just a hard emotional roller coaster. So, how did you react to this when it came around? And I can't can't conceive of, you know, my son is perfectly healthy and all of a sudden not.
So Jackson's diagnosis was actually on April 2nd, which was just a couple days ago. So 5 years ago, you know, believing that you had two healthy children who were successful in school and had great friends and had hobbies and interests and were able to be athletic, to being told in the emergency room, I will never forget the cardiologist asked Jackson, when was the last time you went to baseball practice? And it was on a Tuesday that we were in the emergency room. And he said, well, I went on Thursday. We don't have practice on Friday. And then I didn't go yesterday because I didn't feel great. And she looked directly up at my ex-husband and I and said, I have no medical explanation for why your son didn't die on Thursday.
Wow.
He is going to need a heart transplant.
Holy cow.
And so to go from...
talk about a kick in the head.
To go from a kid who, I mean, Jackson had never had the flu, never been to a doctor outside of yearly checkups, to the only treatment for your son eventually is going to be a heart transplant. We don't know if that's going to happen tomorrow or next week or a couple years from now, but that is literally the only treatment for the disease that we believe your son has.
Takes a little bit to process.
To say that was a monumental moment in our family is an understatement.
Yeah, no kidding. Just to process that. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. So let me ask you, what role has faith played in all this? And I'll start with you, Jamie, and then we'll
ask
Jackson.
I think anyone that has ever met Jackson or experienced him knows he is probably the most faithful person and spiritual person that I've ever met in my entire life. And he's been that way for a long, long time, way before this experience. And I think that his reliance on faith is why he is still alive, frankly.
Yeah.
And I think it is really difficult to engage with him, particularly during this time period where he was going through the transplant process, and not experience God, because he just is so faithful and perseverant in believing that this is all part of his story and this is going to be for the greater good, and that God is always going to be with him no matter what. I mean, I'm sure he was nervous or fearful at least a little bit during some of this process, but not really, because he just always sort of believed that it was going to work out. And so I think as a parent, I couldn't be less than that for him. And so it really taught me.
He set a bar, didn't he?
And he set a really high bar, which I think as a parent was really challenging sometimes to meet. But if he's going to behave in that way and believe so staunchly that everything's going to be fine, like who am I to doubt him?
Sure.
So,
well, Jamie, what was going through your mind when all this came about?
You know, I'm
sorry, Jackson. What was going through your mind? We've heard from you.
I was going to say, I remember they brought a chaplain into our room, like probably a few hours after we were moved from the ER to a room. And I remember saying, I just am so resentful in this particular moment because, you know, I'm a wheelchair user. And I thought, well, isn't it hard enough that my children had to explain to their friends, like, the differences in their mom and sort of how our life was different. And frankly, I was pretty irritated that I had to take all of what I learned as a youth being engaging in medical conversations with doctors and adults and now sort of deploy that same advocacy for my kid. It just felt very unfair.
Yeah.
So that was something I really had to work through in the first year or so.
I think we'll talk a little more about that as we go forward. So Jackson, you know, when it first hit you, what went through your mind?
I mean, I remember initially being disappointed because I knew that it was going to, I couldn't play baseball anymore. Yeah. I had to limit my activity. I knew that I was always going to be different from that point on.
Sure.
But not at any point did I ever feel fear. Not at any point did I ever feel exhausted or hopeless. And I mean, I like looking back, I'm like, man, that was just the worst circumstance you could be in. That's the worst couple of weeks that you could go through as a 12-year-old, you know?
Yeah.
But
existential, as they say.
Yeah. I mean, really. And the only thing that can explain it is the hope and joy that we have in Christ, you know?
Wow. That's super. That is super. And that's the for you not to feel angry. That's a real testimony to your faith. Cause that, and I'm just putting, trying to put myself in that situation. It's really hard. It's impossible to do, obviously. But I would think the first thing I would feel would be anger. So why is this happening to me? You know, and it sounds like you just blew past that and just said, hey, we got a challenge. I guess we're going to work through it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where I got this, but I've always, like something I say to myself all the time is that God never gives you a temptation or a trial that you cannot overcome.
Right.
Because he is the provider and, you know, he will provide you strength and he will provide you hope. Mm-hmm. And so I just remind myself that, you know, that he has a plan for me and he cares about me. So nothing bad can really happen. All these like what ifs or whatever, there's no bad outcome because any, whatever does end up happening is ordained by God.
Sure. Sure.
And so, like you're saying, I've never, been resentful. I've never thought, you know, why me? And it's because I feel like this is such a rare disease and such a rare occurrence. And at the same time, I've been so blessed to even survive through all of this that I just can't but believe that it was, this story was given to me for a reason.
Yeah.
That's how I view it, is that I went through this trial so that I can share it with other people and share it with them, the goodness of God.
We sure do appreciate you sharing with our listeners as well. That's incredible. So I'm thinking through, I'm almost thinking of it in terms of the stages of grief. So you got past the scared part, wasn't scared, or the angry part, I should say, you got past that. Next was be scared. You know, did you feel fear? Did you say, wow, this is too many unknowns for me? Or, you know, I know I've only had brushes with medical world, you know, mainly with my parents and people like that. But it hasn't been me there in the middle of it. So
I guess once that first day happened, once I was admitted to the hospital and once they said, you know, something big is going on here, from that point on, everything moved so quickly, and every time we were just constantly waiting for another test result or constantly going to do another test, or the doctors were visiting, you know, saying, okay, so we have this and this, and what does that mean, and what are we going to do next? And so I was in the hospital for about a month when I was first diagnosed. Wow.
17 days, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seemed like a month.
felt like a month.
Yeah, really.
And well, I was admitted and then released and then admitted again.
Yeah, right back in.
But anyways, and during that time, I underwent every single heart test that a heart, like cardiology, like patient can undergo.
Yeah.
Every single, like, you tell me anything, I've done it. I learned the difference between a CAT scan and a CT scan.
Sure.
And on and on and on and on and on.
Wow.
And there's like four different types of stress tests you can do and just all this stuff. So honestly, I really didn't have a lot of time to just sit and think.
Yeah, to keep you busy.
Yeah. I never was just, because, you know, by the time it was night, I was just exhausted and stuff like that.
Now, was it pretty early on that they said, okay, first thing you're going to get is a pacemaker? Or was that after a while?
So actually, it was a few weeks in between when I was first brought in and then when I was diagnosed and then when they said, you need a pacemaker.
So they sent him home with a heart monitor and basically said, go about your life and we're just going to track what happens on the heart monitor. And so much so that he went on like a field trip with his dad for school, and the cardiologist called me on my cell phone and said, where is Jackson right now? And I said, well, he's on a field trip with his dad. And she said, well, I scheduled him to have a pacemaker put in at 2 p.m. this afternoon, so you need to call him and get him back. And I said, why? And she said, because in the middle of the night last night, there were 10 seconds that his heart didn't beat. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, it's recorded. There were 10 seconds that his heart didn't beat.
Wow.
And he is going to die if we don't put a pacemaker in. And the soonest I could get one is 2 o'clock. This is like 10 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my gosh.
And so
that whole just go about your life thing was kind of out the window.
It was like, yeah, it was like go days. About your life until we call you back.
Yeah. No kidding.
And I think Jackson's point is well taken, that it was just a constant evolution of, okay, we're going to explore this area and then this area and then this area, because restrictive cardiomyopathy, only 1 in every 2 million children is ever diagnosed with it. It's very rare. Wow. And so
it's almost like none of your caregivers had probably cared with anybody.
Well, and then add on to that statistic, the 8 or 9 out of 10 that are diagnosed post-mortem, counts into that 1 in 2 million, you know?
Wow.
So it's even less that actually live with the disease. Yeah.
So the docs are really gathering around you saying this is a rare opportunity for them, really, to work a case like you guys.
I think not so much a rare opportunity, but like such a sense of urgency for our family. I mean, I think the compassion and expertise that we have been blessed with in the medical community, I cannot overstate it. The every technician and person that does scans and testing, all the way through this thoracic surgeon to every cardiologist, every nurse, like the level of expertise and compassion that we've experienced has to be part of the testimony of this story. It is just remarkable.
That is cool.
I can tell you the names of so many, you know, people that they just come in to change the sheets and take the trash out. But, you know, we end up having a conversation and talking. And one time we got someone's pie recipe and just every, like, we've been so blessed to be just constantly surrounded by family, friends, and strangers who just have so much compassion.
It's almost like an expanded family, you know,
I think one of the uniquenesses to the story is that Jackson being diagnosed as a preteen and then getting his transplant as a teenager, because the majority of the children that are in the cardiac unit, either in Cook's in Fort Worth or at Children's in Dallas where they perform transplants, they're infants and toddlers because they have some anatomical difference that is making their heart not function properly. And so it is unique for there to be, I mean, certainly they operate on teenagers, they do transplants for teenagers, but the majority of children that spend a great deal of time in both of those cardiac units are little bitty kids. Some of whom have never been outside the hospital.
Sure, this is like, that's as normal for
and
them.
And so I think for Jackson to be as mature as he is, as articulate as he is, it really gave him an opportunity to be himself and showcase his faith in a way that was really unique because of his age and our circumstances.
Wow. So let me ask you, Jackson, so you knew fairly early on a transplant's coming at some point. And I know that just my limited knowledge of transplants is you get on a list, I guess, and you kind of wait. And how long was that wait for you?
So after they put in my pacemaker, they said, this is just to buy you time until you have to be on that list.
Right.
And so that bought me about 3 years. And in those 3 years, I grew a lot. And by the time my condition worsened in August of 2022, and by that time I was large enough to receive a young adult heart, and so, you know, unfortunately, that means that there are more hearts that are going to be available being in a, you know, metropolitan area like this.
Sure.
And so I was there's three lists that you can be put on. And it's not 1, 2, and 3 for some reason. It's 1A, 1B, and 2.
Interesting.
And I know. I don't
know.
Some
statistician in there somewhere.
Yeah. There's some reason for it.
Yeah.
If you're on the 2 list, that means you're outpatient, you're not in the hospital, and you need a transplant event, like hopefully soon. And that the time they give you for that is, I think it's like 3 to 6 years that you can be on that list.
Yeah.
And then there's 1B, which means that you're out of the hospital, but you have to have constant drip medication. So some IV in you or, you know, other form of medication at all times.
Wow.
And then 1A is you have that constant medication and you're in the hospital. And so initially, they said you need a heart transplant very soon. And so they put me on a medication that was a constant medication, you know, with a what's called a PICC line, which is just a permanent IV. And then they sent me back home and they said, hopefully we'll get you a transplant in 3 to 9 months or something like that. And so then I waited 7 days and my condition worsened even further. They said, we're going to need a transplant for you as soon as possible. So they brought me back into the hospital.
So you moved lists at that point.
Yeah, I jumped up to 1A.
Yeah.
And and so at that point I was on 1B for 7 days. And so they'd said, you know, we have to bring you back in and we have no idea how long it's going to take. So that morning we basically move into our hospital room. We bring all these clothes and even decorations and pillows and stuff. And we're prepared to stay for, you know, possibly months.
You're camping.
3 to 6 months potentially.
Wow.
And, by then I'd made pretty good friends with a lot of the nurses. And so there was like 4 or 5 nurses in my room and we're all taking bets, you know, jokingly as to when I would get my transplant.
Oh man.
And, you know, people were saying,
we had a pool going.
This is your community.
It was like, today is this day. I think it'll take 20 days or I think it'll take 6 days or
it'll be on. Some nurse said it'll be on my birthday, which is in 2 months. And some other nurse said, no, it'll be on my birthday.
Oh, wow.
And I said, nah, it'll be tonight. I bet. Wow. I bet it'll be tonight.
Wow.
And sure enough, 11 hours later, at around 11:30 at night, my nurse comes. He comes bursting in the room and he says, "Where's your mom?"
Yeah.
She's in the bathroom. Okay, well, wait.
I was brushing my teeth.
So, he's sitting. He's like, "I owe you $20." I was like, "What do you mean?"
Wow.
He said, "We found a match for you."
Wow.
So I was on 1B for 7 days, and then I was on 1A for about 11 or 12 hours.
Holy cow.
Which was just...
That's got to be unheard of.
Absolutely incredible. Like, you know, just totally, like you said, unheard of. All the nurses were just, you know, shocked. And I remember, you know, 12 hours from then, I was getting ready for the surgery. And my dad asked my transplant coordinator, he said, "So we found this match kind of quick. Are we sure that this is the right one? Like, do we find it too quick? You know, is there not like maybe a better option out there or something like
Interesting,
that?"
Interesting. Yeah. You don't think about that, but that's true.
And I forget exactly what she said.
She said, "This is the most perfect match we could ever find."
Really?
Yeah.
So not only was it available, it's just the right,
she said,
matched. In terms of like, because they measure all sorts of things.
There's like
size
over
of the heart. 200. And there's like close to 300 different markers and metrics that they use to determine if it's a match. And in this case, it was like more positive markers than they
It was like 98% match or something like that.
Wow.
Like with all those 300 things.
Wow.
And she said, "I'm not, because of patient confidentiality, I'm not allowed to share anything with you specifically," but she said the donor is the exact height and weight as you are right now.
Wow.
Exact height and weight.
Wow. That's incredible.
Which was just great to hear.
You know, emotionally, and I guess this is for both of you guys, but, you know, for you to get a heart, that means something pretty traumatic has happened to someone else. Mm-hmm. Was that a big hurdle? Was that ever like, you know, I want this more than anything because it means my life, but I know there's a cost to this?
Yes. And what I was kind of grateful for was that during those 3 years that I had my pacemaker, every time I went into the hospital was basically, okay, is it time for your transplant? Yeah, we're going to check.
Yeah.
And so I had a long time before transplant to really process.
Yeah. This wasn't a one-day thing.
Yeah, what was, you know, what that really means, like you said.
Yeah,
and the way I view it is that, like, you know, there's nothing I could have done to change anything with that person or to help that person, or there's nothing me being on the list didn't cause that person to pass away.
Very good. Yeah.
But they were gracious enough, and they were, you know, generous enough to just check that little box when they get their driver's license renewed, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's funny that there's. Well, go ahead.
I was just going to share. So, in the time since Jackson has received his transplant through the Southwest Transplant Alliance, which is the sort of coordinating body, we received information about Jackson's donor from his family. But I remember on the day of Jackson's transplant, we were sort of, I wouldn't say live posting updates on social media, but we were sharing the nuances of the experience with people through social media. And so many people reached out and said, I'm so grateful you're doing this because I'm learning so much. And one of the things that we shared was like to please pray for their family. And that was before we even knew who it was.
Yeah.
And then shortly afterwards, we received a letter and photographs and information from the family about the young man who passed away. And I think that for me was more difficult in some ways than even turning Jackson over to the surgical team for his surgery, because it made so real the sacrifice that that young man made and that his family made.
Sure.
And it was clear through the letter that he donated a majority of his organs, not just his heart. And we can talk about how it works process wise, but the heart came to Dallas from St. Louis, and I remember his surgical team sent me a photo of it.
Wow.
And said, this is the heart visualized inside the young man. We think it's a great heart. It's, you can see it clearly beating in this little image. And I remember thinking, okay, what do I do with this photo now?
Yeah,
because this is not. It felt so sacred. It was just a strange thing to sort of have on your phone. And I was like, I can't delete it, but I can't. It's hard to think about.
I never thought about that level of knowledge and detail that you would run into.
And then, you know, subsequently, a few hours later, I got a photo of Jackson's heart that was native to his body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it was stiffened. You could see the size of it was different than it should have been. The color of it was different than it should have been. And they explained to me and to Jackson's dad and our family that was in the waiting room, like some of the things that made it obvious why Jackson needed the new heart. Yeah. But just sort of the dynamics of all of that are really, the gravity of it is so unique. And I pray every day for that young man's family. He was an only child. And so I pray every day for them. And I am so grateful that they collectively made the choice that they did. And I think it informs how Jackson cares for himself now in terms of taking the medications that he's supposed to take and exercising and sort of living life to the fullest that he possibly can, because it's his way to honor that young man as well.
And it's not just you guys. So it sounds like he touched several families. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seemed I will never forget the most conviction and, I don't know, sort of duty I've felt in my entire life was when my cardiologist, after transplant, she looked at me and she said, you have to take these medications on time. You have to, you know, do everything you're supposed to. You have to be conscious. You have to be diligent about taking care of yourself and this heart, because she said, if not, then that person made it like a sacrifice like for nothing. She said, it'll be a complete waste if you don't do what you're supposed to do.
Wow. And how old were you when all that was?
I was 15. And like I said, I was sitting there and I was just like, ooh.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. I mean, there are many adults that can't process that, you know, and that's incredible.
Well, and I think that the other unique thing that they don't talk to you about until you need to be involved in this process is that it is simply a treatment. That when you receive a transplant, a heart transplant, it is not a cure for disease. It's a change from one disease to a different type of disease.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So statistically, you know, it is possible based on today's research, today's technology, that in 10 to 12 years, Jackson will need a second heart transplant.
Yep.
I'm hopeful that with research and technology and advancements medically, that it'll extend the time period, but they can only give you the statistics based on what they know in that moment in time. And
but it sounds like you're doing everything you can do to make the best possible outcome. Mm-hmm. So that's important. So where do you think your strength of faith comes from? It just comes, it's just always been with you?
I remember I grew up and until I was about 8, our family was a family that just went to Easter and Christmas service, you know? Yep. And I remember when my sister was in 5th or 6th grade, she started just getting up on Sundays and she'd go over to mom and dad's room and she'd go, come on, we're going to go to church.
We're going to go to church.
Yeah. And, you know, they would get up and then I'd get up and have to, you know, put on something nice and stuff. And, you know, that was just one Sunday and then it was another Sunday and then it was another. And then we became members at that church and I was baptized there. And now we're at Treach and we've been at Treach for several years. And, and it's been so much of a blessing to be here. But I mean, and then I transferred it to my Liberty Christian School.
Sure.
And there have been a lot of teachers and people there that have influenced me as well. And
yeah, it's a great organization.
I'd really say that my strength and my faith and everything I know about God comes from my community and comes from the people around me.
Yeah.
You know, people just encouraging me, like sending me a text, you know, say, hey, remember to read your Bible or, you know, stuff like that. Every time I'm in the hospital, I have friends and even teachers and relatives and people come visit me. And that always just means just so much to me to think that, like, hey, they're taking time out of their day.
Yeah.
Like a lot of times they have to take, like, off work and stuff like that to just come, like, see me and come be with me. And that is just so...
Not lost on you at all.
No, not at all.
That's awesome.
And I remember... back in 6th grade when I was first admitted, it was a big deal because, like I said, I go to a small school, so nothing really like this had ever happened before at that school. And I had a whole bunch of teachers come visit me, which was just incredible because, you know, you're, you know, just new in middle school and you're in 6th grade and then your principal comes and he's like, hey, man, how you doing? It's like,
oh, wow. And then he got like a handmade card from every kid in the school.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
the kindergartners and everything. So
yeah. Wow. And yeah, they would come and they'd have these boxes and boxes and boxes full of, you know, just cards with little kids drawing a little heart on it. Says, get well soon and stuff like that.
Oh,
and
that's so neat.
Even here at Treach, I have this massive gift bag of the Sunday school here made like prayer chain or something like that. And they had these little like pieces of slips of paper.
Yep.
And each one of them wrote like a little prayer or a little, you know, encouragement or something on it. And they chained them together. And I don't know. There's probably like well over 100 of these little like links in this channel. I just have it in a big bag. I still have it in my closet.
That's so cool.
And it's just
so a lot of support. So a lot of support. So Jamie, from your perspective, how has his faith affected your faith?
Well, like I said, you know, I think it is impossible to encounter him and his story and not see God in it. At the risk of being a little too personal, I remember our daughter, who is just 2 years older than Jackson, when he was originally diagnosed, very casually, she said, I don't think that this story is about Jackson. I think this story is about Dad and all the people that don't believe.
Ooh. Oh.
And I thought, well, crud, I don't really know how to respond to that as a parent, you know?
You have two insightful children, I'll tell you right now.
It was like, well, I, you know, nothing in my parenting books prepared me to answer that specific question.
No kidding.
But I think there's an element of truth in that, you know, you... Like, he hung those prayer chains he was talking about in his hospital room. He prayed before every test. We shared pretty openly our prayer concerns with the community publicly so that they could pray for us. And I just think it is impossible to separate Jackson's faith from this story. I think that's part of why it is his story. And so as his parent, like, not only am I really proud of how he has responded and sort of the maturity with which he's taken on that responsibility of sharing his faith openly, but it's a little convicting in that if he's going to do it so openly, then shouldn't we all do it? Like, he's only 17, right? So I just think it has really challenged me to step out in the ways that I can, not just to advocate for him, but to advocate for God's role in the whole picture of all of this.
Sure. Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put that. So if... trying to think, Jackson, when you go through this, have you talked to other people that have struggled or have been in a, maybe not the exact same situation, but similar situations, real big challenges? Have you been able to minister to them at all?
So, yeah. So, I luckily I've gotten the opportunity to speak at a few events for transplant. I went to San Diego and spoke at the, what was it called?
International Transplant Conference.
Yeah. And then I went to Austin for the Pediatric Transplant Conference or something like that. And I wasn't the only one speaking there. And so I got to talk with other kids and adults that had had heart transplants or other kinds of transplants because of different, so many different reasons and stuff. And I remember, especially with the kids, a lot of times there's that, you know, there's that like stereotype of the hospital kid, you know, the is always, you know,
the Make-A-Wish kid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's and so, and everyone I've met at these conferences and stuff has just not been that at all, you know, like, I remember there was this one woman I met who she was the CEO of her own business and she had had two heart transplants and, because originally, oh, two heart transplants and a liver transplant originally because of, some cancer.
Right.
And, you never would have known by looking at her, you know, she wore a pantsuit and was, you know, a proud, you know, like upstanding woman that was just like, you know, kind of that powerful, like, you know,
not a victim.
No, exactly. And so that's kind of what I always like strive for. And what I want to be is just to prove that sort of stereotype wrong, that just because I have these conditions and diseases and surgeries and things that are often associated with, you know, like, you know, the kid that just sits on the sideline or stuff like that. I just love proving that wrong.
Well, your mom's done a good job proving wrong.
Exactly.
That's people in wheelchairs.
That's exactly what I was going to say is I learned all of that. And I got that ideology from my mom because I got to grow up seeing her advocate for herself as a wheelchair user.
Yep.
And, she just never like let anything beat her. You know, she was always persevering and she was always, you know, unfortunately she was fighting for her place at the table and 9 out of 10 times she got that place and
I wouldn't get in her way.
And so I that it's exactly like you said. That was sort of what was handed down to me from my mom, was that, you know, these they call them disabilities, but like that's such a bad word for it, I think, because honestly I found that it opens up so many doors, you know, and it really allows for so much more than it disables, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I've got it's not necessarily like as dramatic as your story, but I've got a great friend that has volunteered for ages with Special Olympics. And so I'm always following that program a lot. And they have an ad that's on TV now, which I think is particularly powerful. And they have a kid that says, you know, I've got challenges. He says, nothing I like better than a challenge. You know, it's just kind of that attitude, which is your attitude. I mean, that's what I see shining through with you and putting that through. So, Jamie, in talking to other parents that are going through this, what have, kind of conversations have you had? I mean, have you had, I imagine you've had positive and negative and.
So I think there are a few things. I think this is a very small club. Yeah. It is a club that nobody wants to be in. And I'm in a different position in the club because my kid is alive and thriving and articulate and has a lot of different kinds of life experience, both before his diagnosis and after.
Yeah.
And so what I find is there aren't that many parents that I can relate to because everyone's situation is so different. And I feel like, you know, Jackson, from the point of his transplant to when he was released from the hospital, it was only 9 days. So the average transplant, heart transplant patient in pediatrics stays for over a month.
9 days.
So
that's incredible.
It's a record.
Yeah.
There should be like a plaque or something. Boast.
Somehow I'm not surprised.
So, I mean, we've been back a few times and we've definitely had some struggles since. But, you know, I just, it is a very specific situation that we're in.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like you're gloating because look at him and listen to him and whatever. So I have found it to be very isolating.
Because you're
in part because there are a lot of really tragic stories involved with pediatric cardiology. And it is more often than not, not a positive story that comes out.
Right.
And we really are the exception. And so I try almost not to interact with other parents for that reason.
Yeah.
I think where I feel comfortable, and it's where I've always felt comfortable, is in the advocacy realm. So, you know, I have spent my lifetime advocating for equal rights and opportunities for people with all kinds of ability. And I feel like this circumstance with Jackson falls right within that.
Yeah.
So in terms,
I can't think of anyone that was better positioned than you are.
So I sort of turn my energy away from networking with other parents to really like lifting them up in particular ways. Like I said, increasing the education about cardiomyopathy and how it's diagnosed, increasing family leave in ways that allow parents to be with their young children. I mean, I think one of the most heartbreaking experiences for both Jackson and I, you know, I didn't leave the hospital. If he was in the hospital, I was in the hospital. Yeah. And I had to change jobs because of that. And there were lots of different circumstances with it, but I was not going to leave him there by himself. And certainly we would have had other family members or whatever come, but I just felt as his mom that I needed to be there. And the number of children and rooms that were empty, and it wasn't because the families don't want to be there, it's because they literally cannot, because either they live far away or they have other children or they have to work to pay medical bills and things like that. And so I've turned my energy away from sort of networking with parents, other parents, toward the things that I feel like I already have a skill set in. And I feel like that's how I can give back, is to move forward and sort of educate people about just the healthcare system and where cardiology plays into it and pediatrics and all the things. So,
because when people encounter that, like you guys, it was a very abrupt encounter. And how do you figure all those things out? And how do you, you know, where's the roadmap? And you have to kind of figure that out on your own. And I know it's super difficult for almost anyone if you're not part of that ecosystem, I guess. And, you know, I have to learn that. So I think you guys have done a fantastic job. And that's, I think you've zeroed in on a very effective way to work with us, it sounds like.
You know, I had somebody ask me recently, would I be willing to do a training with individuals about sort of resilience and perseverance? And I thought, well, heck, how do you teach something like that? You know, like you kind of have to go through fire to be able to see what you're made of. And it does feel a little unfair sometimes, all the ways that our family has sort of been put to fire. But I think Jackson's point at the beginning is like, God is not, he has always been with us through all of it.
Yep.
And so as long as you kind of keep that at the center, you just kind of keep moving forward.
It was a long way.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's difficult to figure out, well, how do you train for something like that when it's really a mindset, you know, and how do you kind of create that mindset if you've never experienced things that are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like life changing, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So Jackson, have you ever thought about, chronicling this? Did you keep any kind of journal through all this?
That was me. I did that.
Yeah.
You have source material.
I've had several people tell me, you know, you should journal this or you should, you know, write this down. And I have written a large amount down. Well, not large, medium amount. I don't know.
Okay.
Anyways, I have not journaled per se. And, you know, people say, oh, when you're, you know, old and gray, you're going to want to remember this stuff and you're going to forget. But I think like the most important things that I learned from this and the most important things that happened, I just will never be able to forget in the first place.
But telling the story for others to hear, I think will be the important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people journal with no thought that this will ever. This is just me. This is for me to remember, like you said, when you're old and gray or whatever. But there are some of the most fascinating reading out there are people's journals that were never meant for publication, but they tell a story. And
it's true.
You got a great story.
Well, thank you.
So, definitely so. But I can't thank you all enough for joining our podcast. This has been our most unique one. you've heard that most unique probably 10,000 times.
Yeah. That's us. Most unique.
You're the most unique. You get the most unique reward. Definitely so. And I really, really appreciate your willingness to open up and talk about this. I'm sure our listeners are going to really tune into this. This will be our top-ranked podcast ever. I'm very confident. So there you have it, episode 28 of Men in Progress. We hope you enjoyed our discussion and that you'll join us again in May for another special episode honoring Military Appreciation Month. We'll talk with Treach members who are actively serving and those who are veterans. We hope you'll join us for In God We Trust. Thanks again to Jackson and Jamie Blanton for joining me this episode, and thanks to everyone listening to Men in Progress from the United Methodist Men of Treach here in Flower Mound, Texas. I'm Dave Casey. We'll see you next time.
This episode of the Men in Progress podcast is sponsored by Treach Memorial United Methodist Church, where our mission is to lead people into a growing relationship with Jesus Christ. If you're in or near Flower Mound, Texas on any Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you to any of the Treach services. Or you can follow our services anytime on our Facebook page or at tmumc.org.